RTI.
Radio Tatras International, from the heart of Europe to the world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Here's a really serious... Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I've got to mention Mr. Gander because he gets very touchy about things. We've been having a full and frank discussion about things. At least very upset, so we're going to talk to him nicely now. Right, are you ready? Now,
yes.
There is something that is really strange about this story. Or, Mark, you tell me if you think I'm being a bit over the top about it. But I think... if people remember, some years ago, we had this horrendous, awful happening at Hillsborough Football Ground, where lots of people were killed. And ultimately, the blame was laid at the feet of the police.
Yes.
It was said that they didn't actually police the ground properly,
yeah.
And they were blind. I think it was 96 football fans died.
Yeah.
This was back in 1989. And now, all these years later, 1989, how many years ago is that? That's loads of years ago, over 20 years ago.
Mm.
All of a sudden, we have a report coming out blaming Liverpool fans who were attending a match for this awful, awful occurrence.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, but it's not a report. The first thing is, I think that the eventually
it's a revelation.
After several investigations, it was finally decided, I think, that poor policing was to blame for the disaster and that a contributor to the deaths of these, was it 96 people, did you say?
Nice.
And it's not a report now. It's the discovery or the revelation or the disclosure of messages of correspondence.
That's right. Yeah, but if I have to help you out and correct me, what I'm actually meant was there's a report has come out, and it has, because it's what they called when it gets in a newspaper, a report.
Right. Okay. But I'm talking about as opposed to a sort of, you know, balanced investigation.
It's a bit of investigative journalism by the BBC, which is really good. Yeah.
But what's been revealed now is that at the time of the disaster, shortly after the disaster, of course, also there's people trying to pass blame, trying to deny blame and so forth. And what we had is that apparently the police were saying, later on after a balanced investigation were held to be responsible, at the time were saying it was all caused by the drunkenness of Liverpool supporters, and that was the problem, and it wasn't a failure in policing. And of course, Lee has asked now is, why does this seem to be a murky story? Why is all of this coming out now? And I think it's a very good question. And I have to say that at exactly the same time as we're, if you like, having all this disparaging news, which is disparaging of the police in this, we're also now getting new reports or new requirements or I'm not sure how to say it really.
It's
been announced that the police service, this is my view, have got to be subject to cuts. And the police service have got to be subject to fitness tests, and they're going to be sanctions for not having the fitness tests and so forth. And of course, I rather think that there's been accompanied by these Hillsborough revelations in order to make the public hate the police a little bit more, so that they will become more accepting of the painful economic measures that have got to be taken in order, once again, to sort of save the economy money because we're in crisis.
That's amazing. That conspiracy theory had never even crossed my mind, but I think it actually might have some veracity. What I thought more it was about was the fact that the allegations that are being made against the police at the moment because of their involvement with the press and politicians and all the graft that went on and the handing over of cash and the sharing of police horses and all that kind of thing is something which the police are deeply embarrassed about. And if they can clean up their act by denying the facts of what happened at Hillsborough all those decades ago and blame a city of football fans once again for acting in a way which was heinous, then they are doing something absolutely awful. The Liverpool football players have always been accused of drunkenness, and I'm not sure there's any Liverpool fans would never deny that they don't like a drink before they go to the match, and they are quite amongst the wild ones of the football world. But for them to once again be blamed for doing something awful 20 odd years after the event seems shocking to me.
Absolutely. Well, I think what's being said here is that, look, you know, look how the police tried to pass the buck at the time. Look how the police tried to blame everybody else and keep themselves distanced from it all. So, of course, you know, people don't like that. And it is very, very nasty. But certainly it seems to me there's an additional element of nastiness now, because why is this news all being released at this particular time? I never believe in coincidences in this kind of thing.
I don't. I think that's why I asked the question. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, you see bad news, you see nasty news being released. Well, it's always worth looking around to see what else is being released at the same time and what effect on it might have. This sounds to me as if it's government dirty tricks.
Do you think, then, that this could actually be another collusion between politicians, police and the press?
Well, I didn't see...
They're all there. They're all involved.
I didn't see any press tie-in, really. I see a tie-in... For me, I see a tie-in with the... Sorry?
It's being published in the press. The press are actually putting the story out. The press who's telling the world about the story.
Well, I mean, the press is not going to refuse to have the story, and I don't think it helps the press particularly.
How did the BBC get hold of the documents? How did the BBC find out about it?
I'm not saying that they weren't leaked deliberately. Nope. What I'm saying is that I think these documents have been leaked in order to remove, if you like, sort of public condemnation from the idea that the police have got to have pay cuts. Okay, and I can imagine that if there had been a sort of similar kind of bad news about the troops which could have been released in order to justify their pay cuts, that might have happened as well, because I think that's the way it all works. The only thing is that in relation to the pay cuts of troops, I don't think anybody would really dare try to reveal some ancient scandals that might say that our troops are actually a nasty bunch of people.
So, one way or the other, I think we're agreed that there is something smelly. I was trying not to use that word because that's the word that Eric uses, that there is something smelly about this story and about the fact that it's come out now. Yes. And whether it is what you say, which I think is valid, I think it's quite an eccentric point of view, but it's actually quite valid and quite feasible, because this is an eccentric and twisted world that we live in. Or whether it's more to do with what I say, that there is a collusion between the three powers that are all in trouble at the moment to put out something which changes the face of history. And that's what worries me, the way that politicians and the press and the police now rewrite history.
Yes.
I think that is very, very concerning. Here, Mark, here's one for you.
Yes, well, here we are. We've got...
Can I just say, ladies and gentlemen, that Gerard Papadom, right, is one of the wildest, most funny and charming French actors in the world, and he has come out on the side of Mark Gander.
He has, absolutely. But actually, he, as far as I read his statements in the press, he's not being anti-French, but he's definitely being anti-Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, of course, was the former head of the International Monetary Federation, who was on a visit to New York, possibly on business, but also probably involved in swinging parties and so forth, I now understand.
Carry on. Sorry.
Well, you know, like increasing your 1,000 to 1,500 very, very quickly in the space of an evening. That's the kind of swinging parties I'm talking about.
I agree with you. But I also would like to point out, just to validate this story, that Mr. Depardieu, how do you say that, Mark? How do you say that? I've never been able to say it.
Depardieu.
Depardieu. Yeah. Yeah, that'll do. Right, actually says, I don't much like the French in any case. And he says...
I didn't see that at all.
Yeah, he says the French are arrogant. He actually says...
I read that he simply said Dominus Strauss-Kahn is arrogant and smug because...
Well, he's saying it. He's saying that as well. Yeah, he's saying that Dominus Strauss-Kahn is... But he's saying it's because he's French.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm going to say... I don't have that against the French.
Yeah, it says he's not lovable. I think he's a bit like all the French, a bit arrogant. I don't much like the French in any case. Well, he's French, Gerard, you're French.
Well, I have to say, I mean, one can see what he's talking about, and one has a certain sympathy for this point of view. Although my particular point of view is not anti-French, but certainly anti-Parisian, who are nasty and smug and lazy. And that's been my experience of living amongst them for 10 years.
Isn't that almost racist?
Sorry?
Isn't that almost racist?
Well, it is almost racist, and I hope that's what it is, almost racist, and I hope it is not racist.
Why don't you like them, apart from the state of the streets? I've always found, when I've been to Paris, and I've spent quite some time in Paris over the years, I've always found them, a bit standoffish at first, but once you start to talk to somebody in Paris over a bar or in a restaurant... Then they become very laconic and friendly and quite charming. I actually find Parisians particularly to be very stylish and very cool and very, very good looking.
Well, I have to say, I'm just amazed that you find them stylish and cool. I find them just so uncool and so up to themselves. Am I allowed to say that on the radio?
Yeah, say what you want.
I don't think I'm really allowed to say what I want.
I don't think
what I really object to Parisians is the sort of the Parisian culture. I mean, as individuals, of course, I mean, there's good and bad, just like anybody else. But in terms of sort of, you know, the community of restaurant waiters, of shopkeepers, of bureaucrats, of the police, who incidentally are particularly disliked and seen as dangerous and racist, a very, very nasty bunch of people, and very inadequate to policing as well. I mean, I was talking to a police commander who was responsible for the investigation of the police service's complaints, who said, really, that they just hadn't had the quality in their police force. And I can certainly believe that. And I think most French people tend to think that that's probably true. And so from that point of view, I really don't like Parisians. And the other thing I don't like about Parisians is what they do to their city, which is potentially a beautiful city, although it's really static like a museum. I mean, nothing ever changes. It's just guarded. I mean, I see that they're museum curators. But, I mean, back to Gérard Depardieu, who I think is taking on the role of playing... Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was accused of rape in New York, eventually that charge was dropped, has come back to France, has been implicated in further allegations of rape, which have also been dropped, also implicated, and that's still under investigation in the use of prostitutes in swinging parties in the north of France, I think in something called the Carlton Hotel in Lille. So he's gone for his Carlton experience there. And now they're making a film of it. What I'm wondering about the film, is it really just going to be about Dominic Strauss-Kahn, or is it really going to dare to look at the entire establishment that Strauss-Kahn moves in and that is probably involved in...
You mean the establishment in France?
Well, it, he moves in certain circles, and let me say that during the investigations, other members of that circle, I mean, I'm talking about members and ex-members of the government, have been implicated in similar kinds of allegations, although, once again, they're just allegations, nothing's been proved, and I'm not sure whether any charges have been brought. But, you know, there are certainly good suggestions there that, you know, that it is going on, and that as long as you're not silly enough to be caught in an official way... That, you know, your mates will rally around you. And, of course, Dominic Strauss-Kahn's big mistake was to have gotten caught in New York, where he didn't have the old boys club, a problem at the top of
French society, though, is it? You know,
I think it is particularly a problem at the top of the society, certainly in respect of Latin governments.
We're going to move on next to Italy, and if you think about all the scandals and things that have gone on there, the French society, from what I can see, is is a flawed society, very much the same as the society in Britain is flawed. And with this kind of paucity and strangeness at the top of it, at least it's being exposed. It's not being carried out. Well, it is carried out.
Sorry, what's being exposed in France or in England?
Yeah, well, in both.
Well, in France, it's being exposed. I've said to you just now, in France, it's being exposed, I think, because of an accident that it was discovered in New York. Because I can tell you that if it had been discovered in Paris, I'm sure nobody would know about it. If it had been discovered in some other so-called friendly, and I'm not talking about friendly and diplomatically, government, like the Berlusconi government, I can imagine that we wouldn't know about it either. I must say, it does intrigue me to know, to at least ask, whether there's been any association between Berlusconi's crowd and Dominic Strauss-Kahn's crowd. It wouldn't at all surprise me. You know, there's a certain nastiness. Now, I'm not saying that the Anglo-Saxon establishments and the British establishment are not flawed, but it seems to me that they're far more open to scrutiny. For instance, you know, the current inquiries are being made of the press and the current inquiries that are made by the press of the establishment. I don't think that would be particularly possible in France. And in fact, you know, even in the French media, since it's all started to come into the open, there are now big questions that are being asked about the close ties between French politicians and journalists. And I'm talking about far closer than simply borrowing a police horse and the kind of stuff that we've got at the moment with our phone tapping. I think it's very much more serious. I don't think the people trust their government in Latin countries. I don't think we trust them very much in Anglo-Saxon countries, but I think there's far less trust. But I think there's far less possibility of discovering what goes on in Latin governments.
Well, I think that's right. And if all this wasn't happening around us, I don't think that really shows like Postcard from Poprad would exist. It's all grist to our mill, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's move on. Let's lighten the mood again. If it is lightening the mood, but we're talking about Italians and the way the Italians act. In this world, and I think this is just an amazing story that the Italians are actually trying to put a ban on dying. Now, I think that's a good thing. I think we should all live forever.
Yep.
But how can you actually ban dying?
I don't know. It's such a huge question, I can't even begin to imagine.
Oh, I think it's a really good question. It was like one thing I heard a long time ago, which I thought was a really good statement. And it was just very simply that if there's one thing that I have left, one ambition left in life, and that is to live forever. And so far, so good. I think that's a brilliant statement. But this Italian, he's a mayor, isn't he? The mayor of, I'm not going to try and say these places. Oh, it's Carinola, I think it is, right? Has told the people of his constituency and his townships that they can no longer die. This is what he said. There are no more niches available in the citizens' graveyard, so I have issued a challenge on the ordinance, which I say, citizens, while we await the construction of a new cemetery, I order you not to die so we don't have any problems. Wow, can you do that just because you're Italian? Let's attack the Italians for bizarreness.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I think it's a great Italian joke. I mean, it's absolutely super. And I think this is the kind of humour that you associate with Italians. And I tell you what, if one of the 32,000 local mayors in France wrote this, nobody would get the joke.
Do you think it's a joke? Do you think this mayor stood up and said this for a joke?
Yes.
Do you really believe that Italians have that kind of sense of humour?
They
invented the mafia.
That's one of the delights of going to Italian restaurants. You can have laughs.
I've been to an Italian for 7 years. I never got a laugh out of her once, and she never even made me smile.
Well, I tell you, 2 years ago, I went on a package trip to Ibiza for 2 weeks, and it was great fun, absolutely super. It was wonderful, and I was talking to some of the staff there. What do they call them anyway? The kind of redcoats, the Butlins redcoats types there, who were also great. And I said, you know, this is really wonderful. It's a great atmosphere here. They said to me, They said, well, yes, it's a great atmosphere at the moment, and that's because most of the people coming at the moment are Italians. But a month ago, they were mostly French, and it really changes things a lot.
I just thought,
that's really interesting.
Honestly, I really do. I think in Italy, actually, if you go to Italy, I love France, like I say, and in a good-natured way, I like to pop fun at you over your attitude about France. But I do understand a lot of what you're saying about it. It is a dirty place. And Italy is far from being a dirty place. Its countryside is absolutely stunning. I go to a place called Lake Garda, and what a beautiful, gentle and fabulous place that is.
Yeah.
But the problem is, it's filled with Italians. Oh, and Italians are noisy, uncouth, aggressive, and arrogant.
Well, I just think that they're just great and full of
fun. And I based that on my ex-wife. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, darling. We had a lovely time together. No, I do think that actually Italians are quite uncouth. They do tend to spit in the street a bit.
I mean, that doesn't really sort of cause me a problem. I mean, you know, if you go to Italy and basically, you know, people are having fun and they're in, you know, enjoying themselves and they're relaxed about themselves, then for me, you know, that's pretty good. And I have to say, I mean, there are lots and lots of, you know, lovely landscape and so forth in France.
That's it.
But I don't find that people are relaxed about themselves.
Something that I always, something that doesn't happen in Italy, but does happen in France. And I've never actually asked anybody about this before, but it is perfectly true. If you see a program on the TV about France, and it's in the villages, like, you know, these relocation programs or something like that. And you see these beautiful, absolutely fabulous old villages.
Yeah.
There are never, ever any people on the streets. And if you go and in Italy, the streets are teeming. Why don't people spend any time on the streets? Why are the streets always empty? It's a massive country. There's loads of people.
I really don't know, actually. I mean, I hadn't particularly noticed. I mean, I suppose thinking back, I mean, there are lots of places you go and they're not very crowded. I mean, obviously you go in the towns and there's a lot of business going on, a lot of people. But in some of the villages, what have you, there are very few people. I'm afraid I don't know. Other than, and I don't know if this happens in Italy, but there's a huge culture here of second homes, huge culture. I mean, in any sort of long weekend or the holidays, Paris almost empties out. It's really quite extraordinary, and a huge number of people go to their second homes in the countryside. So it could be that, you know, a lot of these places are simply the family holiday homes, and maybe that's why many of the villages are empty. I don't know.
Could be. It's just a strange thing that I've noticed on television, and also I've noticed when I've been driving through France that the villages are empty. It's like nobody wants to talk to each other. It's like it's a very isolated community. The community tends to isolate itself from itself, which is strange. Let's move on anyway from mystery messages from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
Now, this is a strange story, and I don't really know what to make of it, but it does seem quite unusual. There's a bloke called Jack Frozy who died in June last year. He was only 32, and he died from heart arrhythmia, which sounds like some weird punk group, doesn't it? But he left his friends and his family behind, and after 5 months, they suddenly started to get mysterious emails from his email account. Now, what they're saying is that the emails they're getting, because of the way they're worded, etc., can't actually be from anybody else but him. What do you reckon? Do you reckon this is a bit of a scam?
Well, I think it is a scam, but I think the most likely scam is that before he died, he set up a server somewhere with delays and he's having all this stuff sent out. And if that's what he's doing, I think, well, it's a bit unkind to the people whose emotions are hurt. But on the other hand, it's a great joke.
I've never thought of that. That is a very good idea. And what a thing to do. I think that's excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Why don't you cause a few shocks? I mean, it's a pretty cruel joke, I have to say, if that's what's happened. But I mean, I can sort of schedule, you know, messages to go from my email client, my Microsoft Outlook thing. So, you know, I mean, it's not a problem to hire a server to put Microsoft Outlook on it and to have your messages sent out automatically at some time in the future.
I suppose the only thing I can say against that is the fact that if he's got heart arrhythmia,
yeah,
he wouldn't actually know at what point he was going to shuffle off this mortal coil, would he? So he'd have had to planned it in advance quite well. He'd probably have had to have planned his own death as well.
Who knows? I mean, maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's living in South America after having picked up a fantastic insurance thing. After
with Elvis and Jim Morrison, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, anyway, let's move on because we're coming rapidly towards the end of the show now. Yeah. This one just amused me. It did amuse me, and it also shocked me and annoyed me. And that's a take notice of health and safety. And that Leicester City Council, a worker of Leicester City Council, was erecting notices warning the public to be careful in the ice and snow when he slipped and he hurt his back and his neck and his wrist and his arm, the poor love. Right, so obviously the funny side is that he was erecting health and safety notices. But then he made a claim for compensation for what actually happened to him. Hmm. And it looks like the final payout that's going to be made to him by Leicester City Council is £70,000.
Blimey, 70 grand.
Now, how much is the leg worth?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, what it does, it doesn't tell us what the prognosis is. I mean, you know, is he really going to be off work? Is he going to have this for the rest of his life?
Yeah.
It's certainly a load of money. You'd want to know about it, wouldn't it? Blimey.
It makes me wonder. It makes me wonder very much. And then let's move on to the last story of this week's postcard from Poprad. And that's a toilet paper crisis in Trenton in New Jersey. Absolutely. I think this is amazing because the council got charged £4,000 for paper cups. $4,000, sorry, for paper cups. They're now refusing to pay for toilet paper. What is going on in this world?
Well, isn't it amazing? I mean, you're in the loo, and blow me, they ran out of toilet. Don't you hate those moments? I mean, really? I mean, the thing to do, I would recommend now, is that they go into the loo with a paper cup, and while they're sitting there, they unravel it very gently. I mean, it would... Bit more difficult than Bronco, but
Bronco busted. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, but I think it's really incredible that the public building in the capital of the U.S. state of New Jersey is actually going to face running out of toilet paper now following this row.
Absolutely.
And how has refused to pay? This is incredible. $42,000. That's £26,855. Is what the contract for supplying paper, toilet paper to this office is worth. That's incredible. How much toilet paper can you get for £26,000?
I mean, we're hearing about these kind of things all the time. I mean, we've just heard about what was the issue in Britain? What have we been spending money on? Some incredible, ridiculous things, paying huge amounts of money.
Where?
In England, there's just been the MPs have been acknowledging, or is it the police? I can't remember. They've been paying
ridiculous amounts of money on the police over here. Yeah. I didn't mean that, ladies and gentlemen. We're not. I'm talking about the fact that we've decided to cut the wages.
No. Any public organisations are always paying too much because, you know, quite frankly, the money comes too easy. Easy come, easy go.
I think that's right. And I think now we've reached the end of the road as far as this show is concerned. And all
easy go for us.
It's what?
Easy go for us. Easy come, easy go.
Easy come, easy go. That's right. And I think we're about to say goodbye, Mark. Say goodbye, Mark. And
goodbye, Mark.
Ladies and gentlemen, how much you've enjoyed being with them.
I did a lot.
And I have as well, ladies and gentlemen. Next week, we shall have that wonderful Eric Wiltshire back on board. And it'll be an awful show because he'll want to talk about new technology and iPads.
From the heart of Europe to the world, this is RTI.